My hunch is that joy is an ember for our precursor to wild and unpredictable and transgressive and unboundaried solidarity, and that solidarity might incite further joy. These words from poet and best-selling author Ross Gay come from his brilliant book, Inciting Joy. Join Ross for an intimate conversation with Dr. Carmen Rojas, President and CEO of Margaret Casey Foundation at the Margaret Casey Foundation Book Club, Reading for a Liberated Future. Sign up to join the book club today to be among the first to hear about upcoming Margaret Casey Foundation Book Club events. Join the club at caseygrants.org/bookclub. That's caseygrants.org/bookclub. A USDA study demonstrates that bird flu has been circulating in cows for up to 4 months. The Federal Drug Enforcement Agency plans to reclassify cannabis from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3 drug. The Biden administration reinstitutes protections for LGBTQ plus folks seeking healthcare. This is America Dissected. I'm your host, Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed. Over the past year, we've brought you a couple of different perspectives on body size and shape. In last year's episode with Professor Harriet Brown, we talked about the profound impact of diet culture on mental health. Then we did an episode about the new GLP-1 agonists like Ozempic, Wegovy, and Mounjaro, and the ways that they're changing our conversation about body size and shape too. If you haven't noticed, the through line here is that the interplay between body weight and health is really, really complex. On the one hand, there's pretty strong scientific evidence relating high adiposity, or proportion of body fat, to early mortality over the whole population. On the other, though, that optimal level for you or me or any given individual is way less clear. Even at the population level, it's not the, quote, smaller the better, as some would have you think. The risk of mortality is actually highest among the skinniest people. Don't forget that despite our society's relative plenty, for the vast majority of history and in many places in the world today, starvation kills more than obesity. Then there's the fact that it's hard to measure the, quote, right size, and using measures like body mass index introduce a bunch of problematic assumptions about the body density and shape that tend to marginalize communities of color who were excluded from these models when they were developed. And that doesn't even start to scratch the surface on the way that our society perceives and stigmatizes people based on their body size. The risk of eating disorders continues to increase over time, in large part because of the frankly dangerous conversation we tend to have equating body size and shape with everything from moral goodness to discipline to how attractive you are. And then there's the fact that there's a difference between having a certain body size and shape and changing it. Couple all the judgments we heap upon people of a certain size and shape and the fact that changing it is hard, and you get all kinds of charlatans and snake oil salesmen trying to sell you the way to, quote, shed the pounds or look great in a bathing suit. Anyone who's ever tried to lose weight can tell you that it's stupefying. The science alone about what types of foods, when to eat them, and in what quantities, it can be tough to fully grasp. And when you add on the thicket of fad diets built on shaky ground, well, you've got a stress-inducing mess. Trying and failing on any one diet can reinforce the shame heaped on people over their body size and shape, leading people to internalize even further. When you're told the shape of your body is a measure of your self-control, and then the diet you're told can't fail fails, you can imagine the self-talk that can result. And that has real harm, inducing anxiety, depression, and a relationship with food that can cause eating disorders. And that harm has led folks to question the concept of a diet in the first place. A whole crop of influencers have taken that message to social media. On TikTok, and then 2 weeks later on Instagram Reels for us millennials, influencers are encouraging folks to ditch the diet for a more intuitive approach to eating. I've got to tell you, I agree with a lot of that messaging. Too often, we think of body size and shape as a destination, and eating as simply a means to an end. But food is about a lot more than our body size and shape. It's a source of nourishment, cultural awareness, and celebration, and joy. And learning to build a healthy relationship with it, and with yourself and your own body shape, can both help you get to your ideal body size and shape sustainably, and without the shame and guilt of yo-yo diets. But more than that, I believe that so much of the diet culture out there is motivated less by using science and more by the opportunity to prey upon the anxieties of vulnerable people to make a buck. Worse, so much of the situation individuals face is a function of a food system that's been manufactured by corporations that sell us food. They lobby government to subsidize them, making that food artificially cheap and available in ways that maximize their bottom lines. And that's just it. The fight over our waistlines is too much about corporate bottom lines, rather than our well-being. And now it's taken a different turn. It turns out that the food corporations who've been lobbying our government officials all these years wanted to make sure to lobby us, too. And they realized that they might have a natural ally in the anti-diet influencers I just mentioned. Take a listen to this.
Every time I pour a bowl of cereal, I'm reminded about the favorites I grew up on, which is why I'm partnering with General Mills, because everyone deserves to enjoy food without judgment, especially kids. My parents trusted the great taste and good nutrition of Big G cereals, and so do I. You'll find twice as much vitamin D as before, totaling 20% of the daily value per serving, and that is a great reason to keep enjoying those nostalgic favorites from the past.
So that TikTok video may have been created by a registered dietitian, but it's paid for by General Mills. And while that influencer was clear about the partnership, some of them have not been. And that's what reporting from our guests today, Sasha Chavkin and Caitlin Gilbert, found. And when I read about it, I knew I had to have them on to learn more. Here's our conversation about the ways that Big Food is trying to co-opt the anti-diet movement, the impact of big business on our health advice, and what needs to be done about it. All right, can you introduce yourself for the tape?
I'm Sasha Chavkin. I'm a senior reporter with The Examination. We're a nonprofit newsroom that covers global public health, and I focus on the food industry.
And I'm Caitlin Gilbert. I'm a data reporter at The Washington Post. I cover all kinds of data stories to do with health, wellness, science, and many, many other topics at The Post.
You all are my kind of people. So I'm really excited to have this conversation because it captures the contours of a set of intersecting trends that have increasingly become a part of our lives that sometimes I think we're not as wary of. And this story really captures some of that. So stepping back, Sasha, can you tell us a little bit about the role of social media in shaping diet and food trends today? If you're in that world, you see it all the time, but not everybody is. And so can you give us a sense of how this ecosystem works?
Well, social media is becoming an increasingly important source of information for people, particularly younger audiences, about health and nutrition and food. We specifically looked at TikTok and Instagram, which are two of the most important platforms, and we saw that there are a wide variety of influencers out there who are having an important effect on the perceptions of their audiences as they decide on what their eating habits should be.
And how does that influencer ecosystem work? It feels really ad hoc, and obviously it's almost become a cliche now that media is changing and the institutions that we used to rely on just don't have the same power and clout. And part of that has been the influencer ecosystem. But there is money changing hands. Like, how does that work? How does an influencer make their money?
Yeah, I can jump in on that. So influencers, generally the kind of most popular ones with the biggest followings, are getting most of their revenue from major partnerships with brands. And so these are, formal contracts, the same way any kind of advertiser would work with a marketer. They are making sometimes, thousands of dollars per post, which is kind of wild to think about. But people are paying for that audience. Now, even it's common for people to target what are called like micro influencers. So these are people typically around 10,000 to 50,000 followers on these platforms. And they are seen as maybe more relatable. They're less like a big social media celebrity. And they're targeted for that reason as well. In general, people are following these folks because they sort of have these either parasocial relationship with them. They follow their content, they watch how they live their lives, they trust them more inherently. And that's really powerful for an advertiser. So be it a food company or a beauty brand or skincare, like this is just, a perfect target for their advertising messaging.
And when, advertisers have a lot of data about how they choose or target, but I assume that they don't choose these folks at random, that there's a certain set of outcomes that they're going for and a certain set of influencers that they target. Can you tell us a little bit about how that bakes out? Like, how does a company that sells a certain good, how do they find an influencer and say, like, this is our one? Is it normally tailored by the messaging that they offer in the first place? Or is it often sort of just like, hey, I'm an account for hire, and I'm going to say whatever it is that you all want me to say?
I think it obviously depends a bit on the product, but I think it is super common for people who are already organically talking about an idea or message or type of content to be someone that an advertiser or company would want to partner with. They're already organically talking about something. Then the product kind of fits in naturally to their content. It's less kind of jarring to see something that's more of a clash where they're just maybe reading a script or kind of introducing a product that like comes out of nowhere. So I think that is a huge part of what guides sort of the targeting for these influencers. But yeah, it really ranges the gamut. If it's an expert, like in our story, dietitians are credentialed health professionals. They are targeted because of their expertise. And these folks know that, right? The companies, the food companies, any supplement company, beverage company, they'll see that they're dietitians, they're trusted by their followers for providing them, you know, advice about nutrition and health and well-being in general. And that is a perfect target for them.
Go ahead, Sasha.
We've seen that many of the dietitians we've looked at emphasize their health credential when they do their posts on social media. They'll say, as a registered dietitian, I can talk about the health benefits of cereal or whatever product it is that they're either promoting or genuinely endorsing, but that it's not only food companies, but dietitians themselves who really lean on that health credential in order to persuade listeners to trust them.
That's really helpful to understand. And so, you know, you almost got, you know, I hate to use it this term, but like sort of professionals shilling out their training here to put what looks like a scientific sheen on something that somebody's paying them to sell. I want to ask, because there's a particular group of influencers here that we're really talking about, which is this anti-diet influencer. And to step back, anybody who spent any time on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube has been hit by some sort of diet content, right? I get fed the V-Shred guy all the time on YouTube. Like V-Shred is truly everywhere. And you know, maybe it's just the algorithm reading me, but even, you know, even my wife, who has very different interests to me, she's like, who's V-Shred? And I'm like, I'm sorry I did that to your algorithm. I think we share an IP address half the time, so you're just going to have to deal with V-Shred guy just like I do. But you get fed all kinds of content. And, you know, a lot of it is selling you explicitly some diet, some new fad, some new way to, you know, lose weight, look great, you know, be ready for the beach, whatever it is that they hook you on. But there has been a pushback to that, and a really organic pushback to say, you know, maybe all this dieting and all of the anxiety that comes with it isn't great. Can you tell us a little bit about the anti-diet influencer community and sort of what their message has been and what's driven that?
Yeah, so the anti-diet movement started to fight back against weight discrimination and also about this cultural obsession with thinness and unrealistic body images that you're describing. And it's been around for decades, and it's trying to take on what are some genuine serious problems in our society. What we found in our investigation is that the food industry is now capitalizing on that anti-diet message in order to sell products and advance their agenda. So we found through a data analysis that food companies are disproportionately sponsoring anti-diet influencers to disseminate their messages on social media. And then we also looked more closely at one company, General Mills, which has taken it way further than any other company. What General Mills did is they sponsored a study into food shaming, which is a major concern for the anti-diet movement, which they said found that people who reported being food shamed were more likely to have mental health problems, to experience isolation, and also more likely to avoid the cereal aisle in grocery stores. And then they used the findings of this study to push back against a proposed federal regulation that would add front-of-package health warnings to food products. So they essentially said that putting a notice on the front of the box saying that a food is high in fat or high in sugar or some other unhealthy product would be food shaming consumers, and therefore they were trying to stop it from happening.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, food can't feel shame. I can see how this is actually shaming the food, or more so General Mills, the maker of the food. But it's kind of a reach to argue that, you know, the person who grabs for that cereal is now being like secondhand shamed because of what's on the cereal. I also think it, you know, it does speak to the fact that so much of the conversation here has been corrupted, as in good food, bad food, rather than sometimes food, oftentimes food, all the time food, right? And, you know, we had a great episode last year with Professor Harriet Brown, who's written quite a bit about some of the negative consequences of diet culture and has really done some pioneering work talking about this. And the issue here isn't that there isn't a negative consequence to perpetual dieting, both for mental health and for physical health. The issue here is about who's funding it, right? And to your point, when General Mills, that makes money selling you foods that may have negative consequences for a whole number of health outcomes, now sponsors research and then uses that research both in trying to change federal policy, but then also, you know, potentially going out and, you know, buying access to certain influencers and buying their microphone and their camera, that becomes a challenge. Caitlin, I want to ask you, you know, how widespread is the anti-diet influencer community? How much engagement are they getting relative to, you know, V-Shred and some of these other, you know, diet fads? And then when did you first start to see that there might have been some less than organic influence on the nature of the messaging?
Yeah, so it's really, I think asking the engagement question is tough, right? Because I think every one of these platforms has its own definition of engagement, which makes it very tough to say that. But, you know, when we looked from our first story, just seeing dietitian influencers in general, we did notice before we even started kind of quantifying this that a lot of the content was falling under this umbrella, as Sasha was describing, of anti-diet messaging, people talking about methods like intuitive eating and health at every size and food freedom. This just kept coming up and up again with these followers or with these accounts. And some of these accounts are big accounts. You know, we set a pretty clear threshold of around 10,000 followers, but some of these folks have like millions of followers on platforms like TikTok and Instagram. The kind of universe that we were looking at, it was about 40% of that kind of big dietitian influencer category that were kind of regularly using anti-diet messaging. And that group alone had 9 million followers. So it's like it's a sizable audience. And this messaging is also kind of just pervasive, not just online, but also like amongst dietitians. And so, you know, we saw this as something that, you know, we wanted to explore a bit more. I don't think we went into this expecting necessarily that we would see any kind of coordinated campaigns necessarily. We wanted to just sort of see if the anti-diet influencers, that kind of subset, that 40%, were being sponsored in their posts. And we found that a majority of them were partnering with food, beverage, supplement companies. This isn't necessarily evidence, right, of a coordinated campaign. This just suggests that the food industry in general is seeing these folks as particularly good at selling their products, be it that they're dietitians, they're anti-dietitians, regularly talking about how junk food should not be labeled as junk food and foods shouldn't be labeled as healthy or unhealthy. Like the messaging lines up kind of perfectly in this case. For General Mills' case, you know, we saw that there was a really clear example, as Sasha was talking about, of them not only speaking to dietitians at a conference, but also sponsoring specific posts, working directly with dietitians. And so these types of posts were labeled with things like paid partnership, hashtag sponsored, hashtag ad, the things you would expect for, you know, a regular paid partnership on a platform like TikTok or Instagram. And then you look a little closer and you see things like hashtag derail the shame. And so one of the campaigns we sort of addressed in the story is this campaign specifically pushing the ready-to-eat cereals from General Mills. where it's the sort of same messaging being used across this group of dietitians, all kind of talking about how we need to end the cycle of food shaming, how these cereals are really great, and just parroting that language from General Mills at these conferences.
Sasha, can you tell us a little bit about Jay Rashan?
Jay was a woman whose experience we featured in our story. She's a video editor who lives in Wisconsin. She had struggled with weight loss diets for years. And then she goes on YouTube and she encounters a number of anti-diet influencers who convince her to take an entirely different approach to nutrition. They say that restricting food is the worst thing that she could do. They convince her to stop avoiding the unhealthy food she had been staying away from before. And as a result of taking this advice, she gained 50 pounds in a period of 2 months and eventually gained enough weight that she started to seriously worry about her health. And she spoke to us after having left the anti-diet movement because she was concerned that other people who encountered this kind of content on social media might go down the same path. And she wanted to share her story as kind of a cautionary note for people who were in the same place.
And do we have any sense of how widespread that experience has been?
Yeah, I think that's a tough question because we've seen many people sort of share their experiences with struggling with this on various spaces like subreddits, various, health forums. You know, we spoke to a registered dietitian who sees patients in his clinic who says he's seen multiple people come through having been exposed to sort of similar experience that Jay went through, gain a ton of weight because they're following advice that they're getting from social media and really struggling to deal with incorporating those principles into their lifestyle. It's really tough to get a, real number on that just because, people share experiences on social media. But we know that a lot of people are hearing these messages online just based on the sheer number of posts we looked at and the number of followers these anti-diet folks have.
America Dissected is brought to you by Article. Listen, if you love delightful design that doesn't break the bank, that comes quickly and that's easy to put together, look no further. Article has amazing selections of beautiful furniture with incredible design aesthetics. Article believes in delightful design for every home. And thanks to their online-only model, they have some really delightful prices too. Their curated assortment of mid-century modern, coastal, industrial, Scandi, and boho designs make furniture shopping simple and easy. Article's team of designers are all about finding the perfect balance between style, quality, and price. They're dedicated to thoughtful craftsmanship that stands the test of time. I'll tell you that the furniture we've gotten for Article, well, listen, not only does it look amazing, but it holds up to the fact that we've got two children in the house, 6 and 1. Article offers fast, affordable shipping across the US and Canada. Plus, they won't leave you waiting around. You pick the delivery time, and they'll send you updates every step of the way. Article's knowledgeable customer care team is there when you need them to make sure your experience is smooth and stress-free. Listen, I can't tell you how much Sarah and I love our Article furniture. Not only is it beautifully crafted, but it stands the test of time. It holds up to having two kids in the house and two cats. And, well, it fits our design aesthetic. And look, the fact that it comes in 2 weeks or less, and I don't have to worry about putting together a bunch of things with nothing but stick figures to show me how, because, well, it's well-crafted, and I know that both the design and the construction are timeless, that takes the cake for me. Look, you too can enjoy Article Furniture because they're offering our listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/AD. And that discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/AD for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. You know, we haven't gotten as a society the conversation about food and health right at all. And I think, in so much of that is because the focus has not been on what is actually healthy for people. It's been on some of the external goals of looking a particular way. And, as in so many of the challenges that we face, when it comes to health, like the issue is you know, rampant unchecked capitalism. Like one group is trying to sell you a whole bunch of food. The other group is trying to sell you some supplement or diet fad that they say is going to help you. And meanwhile, right, you know, the nature of thermodynamics haven't really changed, and our genetics were sort of set in a time where our food environments were particularly scarce when it came to certain kinds of food, and we now live in a very different kind of environment. And the challenge is that, you know, we struggle with this problem of ubiquity where, you know, we're not very good at addressing the things that change around us, especially if they change slowly. And so everyone looks for answers in, do I diet? Do I not diet, right? Do I eat X or do I not eat X? Rather than asking what is the set of structures, right? The subsidies that are at play when it comes to the price of corn or the price of soybeans or the price of oil that changes what a certain producer can make. What are the policies at play that tell me or don't tell me what I am supposed to know about what I'm eating? And unfortunately, right, and like unless you've really spent some time thinking about who's behind the message, right, it feels like these are all organic. And the issue here really is that we want people to be empowered to make their best decision based on an unadulterated set of messages, right, that are based in science rather than the incentives of some company or another, right, to tell you that you need to do X to lose weight or you need to eat X to save your mental health. And this is that story, and the reason I really wanted to feature it here is because it's a story about how corporations and their interests end up misinforming a public and creating circumstances where people, A, don't have information about what the science says to keep them at their best and optimal shape and health, most importantly, but also about the ways that corporations consistently corrupt to sell you things, right? Because that's the goal here. General Mills wants to sell boxes of cereal. They really don't care about what the diet, what the science says about dieting. They want to sell you cereal, and they worry that public policy could be really effective in getting people to choose other items rather than cereal, which is unfortunately, when it comes to caloric density by macronutrient, really calorically dense and not very dense in the micronutrients that we need to truly nourish ourselves. I want to sort of step back here, right? Because the amount of money, right? Now that we have this sort of infrastructure that is less regulated than, you know, traditional media infrastructure, the amount of money that these companies will invest to launder their message, I worry, is only going to grow. Do we have a sense of how much they're spending on this kind of marketing and whether or not it's impacting public policy?
We don't have figures about particular food companies' influencer advertising. We do know generally that the influencer advertising sector is rapidly growing, both as an overall market and as a share of marketing that companies are doing.
Yeah, I would also add we do know at least the food companies have spent a lot of money just directly lobbying as well on their interests. And that's something I think that's been longstanding, but has kind of continued up until this day. We reported in our story that General Mills alone spent upwards of $2 million between 2022 and 2023 on just like a handful of lobbyists to kind of push back against regulation. So, you know, they're invested for sure. I think generally we also know that the money being spent on influencers from a company's perspective goes a lot further than maybe traditional advertising dollars, like buying a TV ad or buying a radio ad, what have you. It's just so much more value for what they're getting. There's a person who followers are trusting, right? Telling you a message that's even more compelling. It's a real person you've formed some sort of social media, at least, relationship with, right? And it just goes that much further with the influencers.
Hmm. I know there's been some action from the FTC and a few other regulators abroad, although it does seem like this regulatory space is murky. Can you tell us a little bit about how that the regulation of social media influencers works and then what some of these actions were?
So an earlier story that we did on this issue came out last fall, and it showed that a number of dietitian influencers were engaged in campaigns on behalf of industry groups in which they weren't properly disclosing their connections to those groups. So specifically, there were a number of dietitians who had been hired by the American beverage industry, which represents Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and other big soda companies, to dispute warnings from the World Health Organization about the safety of aspartame. And after these stories came out that showed that these dietitians had made posts on behalf of this industry group without making it fully clear to viewers that they were being paid by the soda industry, the FTC stepped in. It sent warning letters to the American Beverage Association and a number of the influencers involved in the campaign. And it also, this was, we thought, really significant, they clarified their standard. And that standard was not just that an influencer has to say hashtag ad or hashtag sponsored, but they have to be clear about who is paying for the message. So even if a viewer knows that it's an ad, that's not enough. They have to know if it's sponsored by an industry that has a direct stake in that message, because that affects viewers' ability to assess the credibility of that message. And so after the FTC sent out these warning letters and stated explicitly that people had to be clear about who was paying them, we saw that a number of the dietitians who had engaged in those campaigns started disclosing more clearly. They started naming who their sponsors were. They started saying in the video of their social media posts, and not just in the caption, who was sponsoring them. So we did see indications of better disclosure after the previous story we did.
There's an additional kind of like level of regulation to this. You know, we asked dietitians about the sort of regulations around what they weren't allowed to do in terms of even just partnering with a food company. Dietitians are, you know, licensed health professionals like any other, and there is a code of ethics around what they can and can't do. And in speaking to dietitians, they sort of told us that many people, you know, get tons and tons of, you know, requests from brands and companies, but they sort of choose to work with brands that kind of aligns with their values, as they describe. That part, I think, you know, defining exactly what dietitians can and can't do, or any health professional really on the platforms, is not exactly regulated, right? The FTC is not specifically calling out medical professionals, health professionals, on these platforms, but they are saying, you know, if you are someone working with a company, you need to make it immediately clear to the consumer viewing that content.
Yeah, there are two other bodies that can act here, right? It's not just the government, which, you know, this is promising, although it's hard to know what the FTC would actually do. Like, there's not really a precedent for like shutting down a channel, but the others are the boards that oversee some of these folks. I was surprised to find from your reporting that one of the influencers that had received one of these letters was somebody that I follow, Dr. Ids, you know, he does these sort of scientific breakdowns of recommendations for eating. But I, you know, it was interesting, right? Because I didn't know that he was, I hate to say it, but like on the take. and it was surprising to me considering his content, but it was good to understand. Has there been any movement from medical boards or dietetics boards to hold some of these influencers accountable for either, you know, taking the kind of industry support that they're taking, or at least not disclosing it?
Well, we spoke at length with the Academy for Nutrition and Dietetics, which is the professional organization for dietitians in the United States. And their president, Lori Wright, said to us, you know, that their code of ethics is clear that, you know, you should not, as a dietitian, be doing advertisements on social media without clearly disclosing it. She described that there was a disciplinary process within the academy for people who violated the code of ethics in any way, which could lead to penalties up to people losing their license as dietitians. But she said that she had never gotten any complaints related to dietitians doing ads sponsored by industry. And so therefore, they had not actually initiated that disciplinary process or that complaint evaluation process for any dietitians. Overall, the response from the Academy was also really to push back on our reporting and to try to downplay, I would say, the idea that this was a serious problem within their profession. So there are mechanisms within the Academy to push back on this, but it seems like the leadership of the Academy has taken the view that dietitians are being unfairly targeted here rather than wanting to take proactive steps against anyone who may have violated ethical codes.
Hmm. And then the other body that could act is are the social media companies. Now, of course, you think about who's benefiting all the way around, right? It tends to be these platforms that keep monetizing eyeballs and eardrums. Has there been any effort to enforce sort of a influencer code of conduct among some of the social media platforms?
Yeah, I think you see a lot of the same stuff where the companies will say, you know, everyone needs to follow federal law, FTC guidelines. There have been some incremental changes done on the platforms in terms of things like, you know, minor things like making the paid partnership tag slightly more visible, higher contrast, something that is even an option, I guess, that wasn't always there. So like little things that are ways in which the platform can signify to a viewer that this might be an ad. But no, I don't think we've seen any kind of, you know, strong push from a platform like TikTok, Meta, to clamp down on influencers, in part because, as you said, I think the influencers, particularly the biggest ones, are the kind of heart and soul of those platforms.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard when you think about the fact that everybody gets a cut, right? Everybody gets a cut, but in the end, the folks who end up paying tend to be folks who leave disinformed by the unfortunate incentives of everyone involved, whether it's the fact that, you know, it's hard to have to regulate on some of your biggest stars in your field. It is, if you're a social media company, your incentive is just to create more content and have more people seeing it as an avenue for advertising, because that's where you make your money, right? And, you know, if the question is General Mills spending money to promote whatever cartoon character on, you know, traditional linear television, or they're spending money on an influencer, you know, that's time spent on the platform for those folks and more content made. And that's what benefits them. And then, of course, for the companies, right, their goal is just to sell, sell, sell. And if this advertising is going to work and it's going to yield boxes sold, then so be it. And what suffers is certainly the audience out there who is struggling to make heads or tails about how best to promote their goals for health. And then, our general ecosystem of knowledge. And one of the big challenges of the social media era, which this highlights perfectly, is that we've gone from being a place where there was some semblance of truth to a place where now it's all takes. And the hard part about take-based communication is that you don't know who's behind what take. And the hard part about this is that they're manipulating a relationship that an influencer has generated with their audience, right, because of a certain level of trust, specifically to drive a take to sell a product. And we see it on across the board. This is unfortunately, the goal of pharma. And, you know, when you think about all of the seeming capital crimes, and I mean, capitalism crimes that General Mills
is accused of here, whether it's buying people's voices or it's lobbying, right? Nobody's done that more than pharma has. And it's to the same goal. We want to sell a medicine, and we're going to make sure that we are manipulating the public conversation. The difference, though, is that they're operating usually in a much more regulated ecosystem. And because of the dangers of this, there's been a lot more effort to try and regulate this. And I do hope that your reporting leads to a certain wake-up call regarding the dangers of just the lack of regulation here and the risks when it comes to, you know, real people living real lives, trying to understand how best to, you know, to improve their own health. I want to ask you, you know, where do we go from here? As you guys think about where this story is evolving, where do you feel like the important next steps will come in?
Well, I think one important response has been within the anti-diet movement itself. One reaction that we felt was really meaningful was that a number of anti-diet leaders have spoken up to say that they think that their message is being co-opted and they're not comfortable with what General Mills has been doing. We spoke with the leaders of Intuitive Eating, which is one of the largest groups within the anti-diet movement. We spoke with leaders of Health at Every Size, another leading group. And both of them told us that this is not what their movements were about. And so I think that part of the conversation that we hope to spark here is within the anti-diet movement. The movement itself, one of its central arguments is that diet culture has been corrupted by the influence of the pharmaceutical industry and other special interests, that everyone who is telling you you need to lose weight somehow has a vested interest in that. So I hope that part of the solution will be a conversation within the anti-diet movement about what the food industry is trying to do with their efforts and what they really stand for. You know, is it about fighting weight discrimination? Is it about fighting toxic body images, or is it about selling sugary cereals?
Yeah, I would just add that I think, you know, at the start of this, you talked about how we're just constantly inundated with this type of information about nutrition, diets, what have you, online. And it's really important because I think it's getting increasingly more difficult to really just know at first pass whether something you see on social media is actually maybe an ad. And in general, to be super, super skeptical of claims that are really big blanket statements about nutrition. I think that's something many dietitians said to us. They said they were concerned that so many of their peers would go onto a platform that obviously incentivizes people to talk this way and without a lot of nuance, but speak in these big generalities when in practice, when they're seeing someone in a clinic, in a hospital setting, they're giving them really custom personalized advice. And that's just not what's happening on social media. And so I think people just should really naturally be super skeptical of the type of content they're seeing on here. And I hope our reporting helps to, yeah, shine a light on that.
Well, it certainly has. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us to share it and to help us navigate how to think about this and to share a perspective on the ways in which, you know, if science and our best intentions should be influencing our well-being, the ways in which the incentives of the large businesses around us may be changing that, oftentimes in ways that are imperceptible to us or even come through the voices of people we thought we could trust. Our guests today were Sasha Chavkin. He's a senior reporter for The Examination, and Caitlin Gilbert, and she's a well-being data reporter for The Washington Post. I really appreciate you all taking the time to join us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Abdul.
As usual, here's what I'm watching right now. A new preprint study from the USDA analyzed genetic information from 220 viral samples from cows infected with H5N1 virus. They found that the first evidence of infection dates all the way back to December, nearly 4 months before it was first discovered in cattle in March, likely in central Texas. Taken together, it tells us that this disease has been spreading among cows for nearly 5 months, and for 4 months of that time, we had no idea it was happening. Meanwhile, the USDA continues to face heat from public health scientists over its slow response
and the lack of transparency in sharing its data with the research community. I can tell you that whatever comes of this, you want to start on the right foot, and speed, transparency, and accurate communication are the hallmark here. This doesn't bode well. And last week, I told you about the FDA's testing of milk supplies. This week, the FDA followed up its testing with egg inoculation tests, a fancy way of saying that they tried to use samples to grow the virus in eggs. The test showed that they were unable to do so, further reinforcing the notion that pasteurization kills live virus. They also tested other dairy products, including formula, sour cream, and cottage cheese, finding no evidence of live virus there either. Moving on, this earthquake of news happened last week.
A historic shift.
One of the most significant changes in U.S. drug policy in more than 50 years.
The Drug Enforcement Administration will move toward reclassifying marijuana
as a less dangerous drug.
This is a big deal for a number of reasons. First, it's in keeping with the fact that recreational cannabis use has been approved in 24 states already, and the federal government has been far behind changing social norms on the issue. A whopping 88% of Americans believe that cannabis should be legal. Look, to be clear, this isn't full-blown legalization, and the administration can't even do that on its own. But it's a step in the right direction. Right now, cannabis is classified as Schedule 1, right up there with cocaine and heroin. But there are some obvious differences here. Schedule 1 implies that there is, quote, no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. You can't die directly of a marijuana overdose, unlike other Schedule 1 drugs. And we've known for a while that it may have some really important clinical uses for analgesia or pain relief and in treating seizures. The problem, though, is we can't know for sure because of how many restrictions there have been on studying it, specifically because it's a Schedule 1 substance. Rescheduling it to Schedule 3, akin to ketamine or anabolic steroids, that'll open the door for far more federally funded research to better understand its clinical uses. And finally, because it's a Schedule 1 substance right now, businesses dealing in cannabis are closed off to certain aspects of the banking sector that themselves come with important security protections. And so rescheduling it will allow companies access to these tools, creating pressure to root out some of the, well, we'll call them less savory actors in the space. But there are worries here. One of the big dangers of legalized cannabis is the ability of a few major players in the space to fully consolidate the market. When that happens and there are a few huge players, their ability to lobby our porous political system increases. And with that, the ability they have to set their own rules of the road. And I worry about what that means when it comes to important regulations protecting children from being marketed to. We'll be watching the space. And for more on this, I hope you'll check out a previous episode called Cannabis Capitalism, where I sat down with Professor David Jernigan, an expert in marijuana regulation. Finally, last week, the Biden administration reinstituted protections for LGBTQ plus folks seeking healthcare. The rule stems from a key piece of the Affordable Care Act, banning discrimination in healthcare more generally. It had been interpreted by the Obama administration to include a ban on discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity in 2016. But it was reinterpreted by the Trump administration to include the narrowest definition of, quote, sex, to include simply biological sex at birth. The new interpretation basically reinstates the Obama-era interpretation. But all of this, well, it highlights just how tenuous this is. A critical fundamental civil rights protection left to be flung back and forth between different administrations, leaving folks in limbo and subject to the whims of the party in power. How to fix it? Congressional action, which, of course, has been a challenge for that body. That's it for today. Thank you so much to Sasha and Caitlin for joining us, and if you have guest recommendations for the show, share them with us at info@incisionmedia.co. On your way out, don't forget to rate and review the show. Look, if you've never done it before, this is the time, especially now that we're independent. Your rating really would go a long way. America Dissected is also now on YouTube. Follow us on YouTube at Abdul Al Sayed. That's also where you can follow me on IG, TikTok, and the website formerly known as Twitter. Finally, to check out more of my content and subscribe to our newsletter, head on over to incisionmedia.co. Also, links to our sponsors are available in the show notes. I really do hope you'll check them out, and please do show them some love. They make the show possible every week. And if you're interested in sponsoring, send us a note at info@incisionmedia.co. America Dissected is a product of Incision Media. Our producer is Andy Gardner-Bernstein. Video editing by Nar Melkonian. Our theme song is by Taka Sazawa and Alex Ugiera. Sales and marketing by Joel Fowler and Nick Freeman at Big Little Media. Our executive producers are Tara Terpstra and me, Dr. Abdul Al Sayed, your host. Thanks for listening. This show is for general information and entertainment purposes only. It's not intended to provide specific healthcare or medical advice and should not be construed as providing healthcare or medical advice. Please consult your physician with any questions related to your own health. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the host and his guests and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Wayne County, Michigan, or its Department of Health, Human, and Veteran Services.